deduct the costs of dredging and processing, distribution and all sorts of extras. Got any ideas on that?
I have, Campbell said.
When Mark first came to me with this idea, I went into it pretty deeply. The main problem is the dredging. A dragline dredge like the one we're using, but bigger, isn't much use at this depth. You waste too much time pulling it up. So I put some of my bright boys onto the problem, and they decided it would be best to use a hydraulic dredge. They did a preliminary study and reckoned they could suck nodules to the surface from 14,000 feet for $10 a ton or less. Then you have to add all sorts of factors, processing, marketing, transport and other technical overheads, the cost of hiring ships and crews and maintaining them. We'd want to develop and build our own dredges. We'd need survey ships, and we'd have to build a processing plant. That would happen on one of the islands, and we'd get a lot of help there, as it'll mean a huge income in many ways for them. But all in all, I would have to float a company capable of digging into its pocket to the tune of some $40 million. He said this in a serious and businesslike tone. Claire was apparently used to these flights of executive rhetoric, but Geordie and I gaped at him. It was Geordie's first excursion into high finance, as it was mine, but I was slightly better prepared for it. Good God, have you got that much? I mean, can you lay your hands on it? Not before this, but I can get it with what we have to show here. We'd clear a net profit of $40 million in the first couple of years of operation. The rest should be pure cream. There's gonna be a lot of guys on Wall Street eager to jump into a thing like this, or even take it over. He mused a bit, then added, but they're not going to. When Suarez Navarro jumped my mines, I swore I'd never hang on to another solid proposition ever again. Not if they were as easy to steal as that. So I went back to being a wildcatter, in and out to take a fast profit. But this, somehow this is different. I'm sticking here. I know a couple of good Joes back home, men I can trust. Between them and me, and perhaps persuading a couple of governments to take an interest, I want to tie this thing up so tight that neither Suarez Navarro nor anyone else of their type can horn in and spoil it. He got up and went to a port to look out over the sea. Tonga's back there. They'll probably come in on the act. They'll benefit by being the ones most likely to get the processing plant built in their territory. It will be highly automated, so it won't mean much steady labour once it's built, but they'll get the taxes and the spin-off, so I should think they will be happy to cooperate. There's another thing on my mind, too. Nodules are still forming out there, and from what Mike says, they'll go on doing so, at what he always calls an explosively fast rate. Maybe for once we'll be able to do a mining operation without raping the goddamn planet. He came back to the table and picked up his glass. And that's an achievement that any bunch of guys can be proud of. Let's drink to it. So we drank, very solemnly. I, for one, was full of awe at what we were doing, and I thought the others felt the same. Campbell had come up with a couple of shattering thoughts. 4. We stayed in the area for another week, quartering the submarine valley and dredging at selected spots. The material poured in, and I was kept busy. A much more detailed survey would be done later. All I was aiming at was to put limits on the area and to find out roughly how rich and how consistent it was. Esmeralda was a happy ship in those days. Not that she hadn't been before, but the depression caused by a fruitless search had lifted, and everyone was keen and cheerful.
There was a lot of skylarking among the crew, although it always stopped when there was some serious work to be done. Once, when I was having a breather on deck, Paula joined me.
"I don't know what came over me the other day, Mike. You know, when Mr. Campbell said I had a share in all this."
"It is a bit of a shock when you find yourself suddenly on the verge of riches. I went through it, too."
"I never thought of being rich," she said.
"I never had the time, I guess. I've always been on the move. The States, Mexico, Australia, Tahiti, Hawaii, Panama. Guess I was a bit of a hobo." She looked up.
"That's what you British call a tramp, isn't it?"
"That's right."
"I guess I was that, too. In the American sense, I mean," she said, somberly.
"You're all right, Paula," I said warmly. "Don't worry about it. Enjoy the idea instead."
"What will you do with all your new-gotten wealth?"
"Gee, I don't know, Mike. I'm not like Claire. She's used to money, but I'm not. And the way her pop talks sometimes makes my head spin, the way he juggles his millions. Maybe you can go on a cruise ship to sunny Tahiti," I said jokingly. But she shook her head violently.
"No, I'll never go there again. I never want to see Papiti again."
She was silent for a while, and we stood together companionably, and then she said,
"I think I'll go home first."
"Yes, I think I'll go home."
"Where's home?"
"In Oregon, just a small town. There aren't many big ones in Oregon. It's called Medford. I haven't been there for years, and I should never have left it."
"Why did you leave Paula?"
She laughed.
"It's a bromide, a cliché, you'd say. My whole life's been a cliché. I got movie crazy when I was a kid, and when I was 16, I won a local beauty competition. That gave me a swelled head and a big mouth. You should have heard me talk about what I was going to do in Hollywood. I was going to knock 'em cold. So I went to Hollywood, and it knocked me cold. There are too many girls like me in Hollywood. I told you the story was a cliché."
"What happened after Hollywood?"
"The cliché continued. I drifted around, singing in cheap night spots. You know the rest, or you can guess it."
I was saddened by the bitter resignation in her voice.
"That place where you found me in Panama, that was the best paid job I ever had in my whole life.
And you left it, just like that, just because I asked you to."
"Why not?"
It was Mark, you see."
"Oh, I know how you feel about Mark. I've heard you talk. All right, supposing he was a lousy no-good. I guess I always knew that, but I loved him, Mike. And I suppose I was stupidly hoping to find out if he'd ever loved me. I always wanted to do whatever I could for him."
I remained quiet. There was nothing I could say to that.
"Yes," she went on quietly, "I do think I'll go home. I always boasted that I wouldn't go back until I was a success. I guess they'd call me a success now, Mike."
There were tears in her eyes. "You've always been a success," I said gently, and held her shoulders. She sniffed a bit, and then said, shaking her head briskly, "This isn't getting the glassware washed. I'd better go back to work. But thanks." I watched her walk along the deck, and for the thousandth time, I damned Mark's soul to hell. At a touch on my elbow, I turned to find Geordie.
"I didn't want to bust up the tit-to-tit," he said, "so I waited a bit."
He nodded along the deck.
"Falling for her, mate?"
"Nothing like that," I said, amusedly, thinking how very off-target Geordie's guesses were. "But there are times when I wish Mark had never been born."
"Give her a bad time, did he?"
"Curiously enough, he made her very happy. But he broke her heart by getting himself killed. Not that that matters. He'd have found some way of doing it, sooner or later."
"What's on your mind, Geordie?"
"I want to talk to you about our next move," he said,
We can't stay out here much longer, mate. The winch and its components really desperately need attention. We're a little low on water. We haven't had time to top up completely in Nuku'alofa, and that goes for fuel, too. And we've been using an awful lot of that for station keeping. We'll have to put into port somewhere pretty soon. Yes, my lab stocks are running low, too. Look, Geordie, we're really finished here. I've got loads of data to work on already. Let's put it to the boss again. Campbell said, "How soon can you finish here, then?" "Oh, I am finished, virtually. This last stretch today could be it. Otherwise, I could go on tinkering forever." "That's it, then. But we don't go back to Nuku'alofa, in case Ramirez is still there, or hunting for us in that area. We'll go to Fiji, to Suva." I hesitated. "That's fine, but I'd like to have a look at Falcon." "What for?" I said, "Well, it's responsible for all this." "A scientist to the last, eh? You're not content with finding anything. You want to know when and how and why." I was desperately keen to visit the island, or the sight of it. I added, to give force to my argument, "It could well give us a lead to other high cobalt areas hereabouts. Maybe concentrations of other metals? Once we find out something about the mechanism of this thing." He laughed. "Okay, Mike. I guess you've earned it. If Geordie gives the go-ahead, we'll go to Suva by way of Falcon." Geordie wasn't too certain. He pulled out his charts, measured distances, and grumbled. "How long are you staying there?" "Well, only a day or so, if that." "Will you be dredging?" "There'll be no need to dredge. It's very shallow over the site. A good swimmer like Bill Hunter could go down and collect the samples I want by hand, and it won't be more than a few fathoms, and he's dying to show off his talent. We could be away again in just a few hours." "It's cutting it a bit fine," he complained. "We'll be damn low on water by the time we get to Suva, and it's a good job you don't want to dredge, because I really think this one was our last. We have to keep enough fuel oil for manoeuvring and for emergencies. I can't spare any more for the winch mower." "Ah, where was he, Geordie? You know you hate sailing under power." But I got him to agree in the end. We finished with the dredge and stowed the cable for the last time. The dredge buckets were secured on deck, and Geordie set a course northward for Funua Fa'u. That evening in the saloon, I said, "I'd like to summarize what I found. Can you stand another short lecture?" We were moving briskly along with a helpful wind. The treasure had been found, and any danger seemed infinitely remote and unlikely. My seminar settled down to hear me, out in a state of contentment. Campbell said, "I'm getting used to being lectured to by scientists. It's sometimes boring and usually profitable." I laughed. "This time, it's very profitable." I produced my charts and notebook. The high cobalt nodules seemed to be concentrated in a valley or depression, 20 miles wide and 100 miles long. The nodules lie in varying degrees of richness and density. Claire, whom I had discovered to my pleasure to be a quick natural mathematician, said in astonishment, "But that's 2,000 square miles. "Quite an area," I agreed. "The richness varies roughly with the depth of water, from about 2% at the top of the ridges to a peak of 10% in the valley bottom, and inverse curve, if you like. On the other hand, the density varies in a different way. At the extreme north of the valley, the density is only 0.5 pounds per square foot. At the other end, it peaks out at 50 pounds per square foot." Campbell said, "Still at 10% cobalt? On the valley bottom, yes." "Hot diggity," he exclaimed. $250 million a square mile." He and Claire were smiling in delight. Geordie looked dazed, and the figures were so fantastic that he couldn't absorb them. Paula looked petrified. I consulted my notebook again. I've worked out some rough figures. I reckon the overall average density over the entire area of 2,000 square miles is about 8 pounds to the square foot. The overall richness is about 6%. Considering some of the higher figures, though, you're in for a very fine haul wherever you begin. So, systematic mining will pay off. Campbell said, "Those average figures of yours don't mean a damn thing, Mike. What do I care if the average density is 8 pounds when I know of a place where it's actually 50? That's where we start. We take the rich stuff out first." He shook his head in wonder. "This is fantastic. This is the damnedest thing. We can prove every pound of our resources before we even start. We'll need a detailed survey, though, with you to head it up." "I'd be proud to," I said. I thought of the advanced equipment and systems I could use and rejoiced inwardly. "I'll give you the finest survey vessel ever built, with no disrespect to Esmeralda, Geordie. But then, you may not want to do this. You'll be a rich man." He got up to pour us all drinks as he spoke. "I won't be until that survey has been made and the operation started," I pointed out. "But you couldn't stop me even then." Campbell said, "I've been thinking this thing out. I'm starting a corporation, and I'm reserving 5% of the stock for the crew. 3% goes to you, Mike, and 2% to Geordie. I'll sell 20% to those two guys I know that I mentioned for $20 million, and let the government, any or all of them, have 50% for another $20 million. That starts to take care of the working capital." Claire exclaimed, "Pop, I'm disgusted at you. Don't think I can't add up percentages. You come out with 20% for yourself, and you've discovered nothing. All you've done is put up a measly $1 million or so for this expedition." "Not quite, Claire," he said, mildly. "There's your cut, another 5, I think. And I have ideas concerning the remaining 15. For centuries, people like me have been taking metals out of the earth and putting nothing back. We've been greedy. The whole of mankind has been greedy. As I said the other day, we've been raping this planet." His voice grew in intensity. "Now we've got hold of something different, and we mustn't spoil it, like we've spoiled everything else that we've laid our greedy hands on. I'm keeping 5% for myself, sure. But the other 10 will go into an independent, non-profit-making organization, which will push my ideas a little further. We have to find a way to take that stuff out of the sea without disturbing the environment more than we can help, and to put something back, somewhere, by way of recompense." "There's one way that I can think of immediately," I said. "There are phosphorite nodules as well. You can make good fertilizer out of them, but so far no one has thought of a way of dredging them commercially. We could get them up with the rest, and you could be doing agriculture a bit of good." "That's what I mean," Campbell exclaimed. "You've gone to the heart of it. Research is what's needed." His eyes crinkled. "How would you like to head up a new foundation?" "Good grief. I wouldn't know where to start. I'm a field man, not an administrator. You want someone like old Jarvis. You wouldn't be an administrator. I wouldn't waste your time on that. I can hire managers, but you'd be in charge of research." "Then nothing would stop me taking it on," I said, dazzled. "That's my boy." He lifted the bottle and inspected it critically. "Nearly the last of the scotch. Never mind, we can get some more in Suva." 5. I was below when I heard the engine start, so I strolled on deck to find Geordie at the wheel. It was a calm evening, without a breath of wind,
and there was no sound except the throb of the engine, which drove Esmeralda over the placid sea.
"It's lucky you kept some fuel back," I commented, looking at a steadying sail hanging limply.
"Got a few gallons up my sleeve. I always save a little more than I let anyone know.
Mate, what's the depth of water at Fanuafu'u?"
"I don't know, Geordie. It varies from year to year. The pilot gives the latest depth in 1949 as about 54 feet, with no sign of the island at all. But it was there in 1941, though there seemed to have been less of it than there was reported in 1939. A shoal at the northern end had vanished in those couple of years." He wasn't happy with this.
"We'll have to go very canny then.
We've been around shoals before, Geordie, and we know exactly where this one ought to be.
So what's the problem?"
"I don't like this."
"You don't like what?"
"This weather." I looked across at the setting sun, and then to the east. The sky was cloudless, and everything was peaceful.
"What's wrong with it?"
"I dunno," he said. "I just got a feeling. I don't like that yellow tinge on the horizon northwards. Maybe there's a storm coming up."
"How's the barometer?" I asked.
"Still normal. Nothing wrong there.
Maybe I'm being a bit old womanish."
He called Taffy to him and handed over the wheel.
"Keep a bloody close watch on that echo sounder, Taff," he said.
"By my reckoning, we should be nearly there. We've been running long enough. Ian, set a watch out. If there's nothing before dark, we'll circle back and come up again in the morning."
He was more twitchy than I'd ever known him, and I couldn't quite tell why.
Certainly, it didn't appear to have anything to do with a possible chase by Serena. We'd seen nothing and had no reason to suppose that she would find us. She'd scarcely be waiting at Falcon Island as if it were a handy street corner, I thought. And while my weather sense was not nearly as acute as Geordie's, I had had my share of storms and could see nothing in the sky or on the sea's surface to excite alarm. I didn't push him, and finally turned in to leave him pacing uneasily in the darkness, turning Esmeralda back on her track for a loop during the night hours. The morning brought more of the same weather, or lack of it. It was calm, quiet and peaceful as we gathered on deck to watch for any telltale breakers, while Geordie brought the ship gently back to her last night's position, and then motored slowly ahead. Presently he throttled the engine back to less than 3 knots. The echo sounder showed 100 fathoms. Campbell and the girls joined us on deck, and their voices were unnaturally loud in the hush of morning. And Geordie said quietly, "The bottom's coming up, only 50 fathoms. He throttled back the engine still further. Claire said, "Is this Falcon Island?"
"Dead ahead, but you won't see anything, though," I told her. "Just another bit of sea."
20 fathoms, called Jim, at the echo sounder. Geordie had taken the wheel again and repeated the call, then cursed suddenly.
"What the hell's going on? What's the matter? I can't keep the old girl on course."
I looked across the sea path to the rising sun. The sea had a black, oily look and seemed as calm as ever, but then I noticed small eddies and ripples here and there in an otherwise motionless seascape. It was a strange and disturbing sight. They weren't large, but I saw several of them. I felt Esmeralda moving under me, and she seemed to be travelling sideways instead of forwards. Something else nagged at my senses, but I couldn't quite identify it. Geordie had got control again, apparently. As Jim called out, 10 fathoms, he put the engine out of gear, and as we glided to a rocking stop, his hand was on the reverse gear, ready to send it home. Jim was calling steadily, 9 fathoms, 8, 7. At 6.5, Geordie touched the engine into reverse, and the sounder came back up to hover at 7 fathoms. Geordie said,
This is it, as far as I'll go. He looked and sounded bothered. Is Bill ready? Diving in 6 fathoms, 36 feet, was going to be no problem to Bill, who was already kitted up in a wetsuit and aqualung, and was dipping his mask into a bucket of seawater someone had hauled up on deck. He already had his orders, and they were of the simplest. He was to take down a couple of sample bags and bring me back a little of anything he could see. I didn't expect nodules, but the cinder and shell-laden bottom material would be fascinating to me. I had expected him to take someone else down with him in the accepted buddy system, but he was scathing about it and said he preferred to dive alone. "When you want a buddy most is on the surface," he told me, overturning most of my accepted belief at a stroke. "You get disorientated pretty fast down there, even in clear water like this, and half the time you're not in sight of one another." So we'd put the smaller dinghy into the water, and it was from there that Bill would launch himself into the sea. "It won't take long," he promised Geordie, and I felt sure that we could be away in an hour or so. As he prepared to climb down into the dinghy, he paused, sniffing the air, and commented, "Someone hasn't washed their socks lately." That was the thing that was niggling at my mind, and recognition brought a stronger sense of unease. There was a heavy, sulphurous smell in the air. Geordie and I looked at each other, and he said, "Sulphur, Mike?" "Well, this is a known volcanic region," I said. "I suppose it's always a bit niffy here." Ian spoke, pointing out to the horizon. "You can almost see it in the air, Skipper." The sky, low down, was brightening into the dawn, but there was a strange yellow tinge to it. Bill was in the dinghy now, with Jim and Rex Larkin, to row it a few yards off from Esmeralda. He sat on the thwart, gave the traditional thumbs-up sign as he made a final adjustment to his mask, and toppled backwards into the sea. For a few moments we could see his body sinking away from the dinghy. He had just disappeared when Geordie said hoarsely, "Bill, stop him! Don't let him dive!" It was too late. Several heads turned to stare at Geordie, who had suddenly gone ashen and was wrestling with the wheel, and at the same moment there was a babble of talk from the men at the bows and railings. "For God's sake, we're spinning," Geordie said, and I saw then what he meant. Esmeralda was boxing the compass. Her bows swept slowly over the horizon as she twirled in a complete circle, not very fast, but with a suggestion of power in the colossal eddy that had her in its grip. And at the same time, I saw a rising column of mist, darkening even as it rose, that appeared as if by magic out of the sea, half a mile or so away from us. There were shouts of alarm from people, and I clung to a stanchion to steady myself as we spun about. Almost as soon as it happened, it had ceased, and Esmeralda was rocking tipsily, but steadying up again with the billowing, steamy cloud ahead to starboard. I saw other little eddies appear and vanish on the sea's disturbed surface, and the smell of sulphur was suddenly pungent. I heard Geordie shouting, but for the moment a ringing in my ears made it sound very faint and distant, and I shook my head to clear it. "Ian, this is bloody dicey, but we've got to get an anchor down. We'll lose the dinghy and Bill both if we start shifting." I heard the anchor cable rattle out of the hawse pipe, almost as he spoke, tethering Esmeralda to the shallow bottom. I could guess how reluctant Geordie would be to sacrifice his precious mobility at that moment, but it was, of course, essential to keep station. The dinghy rocked heavily, and I saw a line being thrown to her, presumably to keep her in contact with us. Campbell's body lurched into mine as we swung round the anchor cable, and Geordie called, "Not enough! She'll swing into the dinghy! We have to get Bill up fast!" But he had gone down freestyle without a line, and there didn't seem to be any way to do it. I saw that some of the crew were swinging out the motor launch and guessed that Geordie would use it to take up the dinghy crew into a more seaworthy craft, leaving the small boat in tow. "How long will he stay down?" I asked, staring over the side. The whole surface of the water was rippling and beginning to chop.
"Not long at all," Geordie said, tensely. "The moment he breaks surface, we'll have him up out of there. With any luck, there'll be enough disturbance down below to get him up quickly. Thank God it's shallow. At least he won't have a decompression problem."
"What's happening?" Campbell's voice sounded as if he'd asked that question several times already. I said, "Wait a moment, I'll explain later." I was staring at the column rising from the sea as if mesmerized. There was hardly any noise, but the column blackened steadily, with a white nimbus around it, almost like the smoke of an oily fire. And I knew without a doubt that if there was no underwater disturbance to bring Bill to the surface, there was another phenomenon that would work as well. The sea would be rising in temperature, not to boiling point, at least not here, but several degrees above its normal state. I knew that I was looking at the beginning of an underwater volcanic eruption, and my heart was thudding as if my chest would burst open. Geordie guessed it too, and a ripple of awareness ran through the crew. Campbell's mouth hung open, and his hand fell away from my arm. Eyes were scanning the water near us, looking anxiously for our diver's reappearance, and glances over our shoulders kept us in touch with the increasing activity away on the horizon. Esmeralda was still rocking a little roughly, but there was no feeling of instability about her. Something broke surface not far from the dinghy. "There he is," called Danny, pointing. We saw the two men still in the dinghy, pulling Bill in over the thwarts, the motor launch waiting off to take her in tow back to the ship when there was a totally unexpected interruption. Taffy Morgan shouted, "Ship on the starboard beam!" I swung round incredulously and pounded across the deck, colliding with someone on the way. Out of the smoke and steam that drifted across the sea ahead of us, half shielding her until the last possible moment, the bulk of Serena came bearing down upon us. Her yards were bare, and she was pounding towards us, full tilt under power. I could see figures on deck, many of them, and the lift of her bow wave as she approached. "God damn it! We're trussed up here for the slaughter," Campbell said, in vicious unbelief. Geordie ran up the deck. "Slip that flaming cable," he bawled, but there wasn't enough time. Serena was on us, slewing, and with her speed falling off at the last possible moment to lay alongside us with a minimum of seamanship, relying totally on surprise to aid her terrible attack. She didn't quite make the turn, and her bowsprit stabbed at us like a monstrous rapier. There was an almighty crash, and Esmeralda shuddered violently and moved bodily sideways in the water. I was thrown against Geordie, and we both went down in a tangle of arms and legs. I scrambled to my feet, all the breath knocked out of my body, and saw hazily that Esmeralda's yardarm was locked in Serena's shrouds. Ramirez had rammed us. The chaos was indescribable. There was a roar of angry voices, and a flood of men poured across the deck from Serena, and I saw the flash of knives in the enveloping glow of that fantastic yellow light. 8. It was a short fight, and a bitter one. In the fraction of a second before they were onto us, I saw Campbell's incredulous face, his mouth open in surprise. Then Geordie roared, "Stand together, lads!" And I was grappling with a hefty brute who wielded a long and wickedly gleaming knife. If he had come at me from underneath, I might have been disemboweled, but he used the basically unsound overarm stab. I saw the knife coming down, grasped his wrist, and pulled. This unexpected assistance sent him off balance. I did a neat sidestep, more suited to the dance floor than the battlefield, twisted his arm,
and pushed. He reeled into the scuppers, and his knife clattered on the deck. I looked around, and all was confusion. I scarcely had time to distinguish friend from enemy before I was attacked again. I felt a cold burn sear along my ribs as the knife struck, and in desperation I hit out, slantwise with the edge of my hand, at the blurred figure before me. There was a choked gurgle, and the blur vanished. I hoped I'd smashed his larynx. I staggered up, clutching at a stay for support, and as I wavered about the deck I saw Campbell go down under a vicious, smashing blow from a belaying pin, and then I saw the unmistakable bulk of Jim Hadley. He had got hold of Claire, and was twisting her arm behind her back, and she was screaming in pain. I couldn't hear her because of the tumult around me, but I saw her wide-open mouth and the glaze of terror in her eyes. I was about to plunge across the deck when there was a staccato rattle of shots, and everything seemed to pause momentarily. I took the opportunity to yell, "Stop fighting! For God's sake, stop fighting!" The roar began again, only to be halted by another fusillade of shots. A voice called, "Very wise, Mr. Trevelyan." Then came a rapid spate of Spanish, which I was too dazed to follow. I called out, "Hold it, lads, they have Claire!" We had been defeated in less than 3 minutes. Everything stopped as suddenly as it had begun. I felt the burning ache along my ribcage as only the most minor of distractions, as I looked hastily around the deck. There seemed to be Spaniards everywhere, far more of them than us, and three men lay on the deck without moving. Ramirez stepped delicately across the deck, with two armed men at his back. I had time to wonder where he'd got a fresh load of weapons from, and then he faced me. "We meet under different circumstances, Mr. Trevelyan," he observed with a mocking smile. I ignored him. "Everyone all right?" There was a low murmur, and then Taffy looked up from one of the prone figures, white-faced under his tan. "They've killed Danny," he said, in a level tone. Over a rising growl, I yelled, "Cut it out! Look at Hadley!" There was a dead silence. Hadley had forced Claire to her knees. He had her right arm up behind her back, and in his other hand he held a heavy pistol trained on the nape of her neck. Ramirez stood in front of me, nodding appreciatively. "You have sense, Mr. Trevelyan. You've lost, and you know it. Tell him to let her go. In a moment." He passed along the deck and came to Geordie, who stared at him impassively. "Ah, the brave Mr. Wilkins. I told you that you would regret what you did one day." He lifted his hand and struck Geordie across the face with a backhanded blow. A ring cut deep, and blood started to drip from Geordie's mouth. He spat on the deck in silence. Campbell moaned and tried to lift himself from the deck, and Ramirez strolled over to look down at him with an odd expression on his face. It was almost as if he contemplated the defeat of an old adversary with less than satisfaction. "Come on, old one, get up," he said brusquely. Campbell got halfway up, then collapsed again. Ramirez made an impatient noise. He pointed to Taffy, still crouched over Danny's body. "You, carry the old man into the saloon." Taffy and Ian, between them, got Campbell up. There seemed to be something wrong with his side, as if his leg was paralyzed. As he lifted his head, I saw an ugly blotch of blood on his left temple, and rage rose bitter in my throat at the sight. Ramirez gestured to Geordie with his pistol. "You too, into the saloon. And, Mr. Trevelyan, you too, please. We mustn't forget you." A rifle muzzle poked me in the back, and I walked helplessly towards the companionway. I turned my head and saw Hadley dragging Claire to her feet and pushing her forward. I wondered where Paula was.
Before we were thrust into the saloon, we were brusquely searched. The man wasn't too gentle, and I gasped with pain as the heel of his hand slammed against the wound in my side. He just grinned, but it was a mindless rather than a sadistic expression. I thought in that moment that there seemed to be a minimum of brain power around. These men were mostly obedient puppets, no more than that. It might be useful, I thought, and wondered at myself. In the saloon, I helped Taffy to lay Campbell on a settee, and said in a low voice, "You're sure Danny was killed?"
"I'm sure," Taffy said tightly. "He was stabbed in the chest. God, the blood."
I looked at Campbell. His eyes were open but unfocused. I said, forcing my voice to a normal conversational pitch, "The old boy's had a nasty knock. You'll find some water in the liquor cabinet, Ian." I looked around for Claire and found her coming to my side. Hadley had let her go, and she was very pale but fully composed. Our hands found each other's for an instant, and then she was looking at the blood on her fingertips.
"Mike, you're hurt."
"I can wait, it's nothing. You'd better see to your father first." She went to him and began to sponge his head with a cloth dipped in the jug of water Ian held for her, her face clouded with fear and worry. Paula was thrust into the saloon. She stumbled and nearly fell as her guard gave her a brutal shove before he took up a position near the door, his rifle pointing at us. I took her arm to steady her. "Paula, are you all right?"
"I guess so," she gasped.
"I still got a whole skin." She looked round and then said to me in a lower voice,
"I saw them putting two of our men in the cable hold, Mike, and they've hauled in the motor launch too."
"Christ," said Geordie. He wiped the back of his hand across his mouth and looked without surprise at the blood. He did a quick calculation on his fingers and then said, "The two on board must have been Shorty and Davy Blake. The rest of us are here, or..." Paula took him up.
"Nick Duggan and young Martin were in the launch. I saw them both. I don't know about the other."
They were the only two who had been in the launch, and it wasn't surprising that Ramirez had spotted them and fetched them back. But there were still Jim and Rex Larkin in the dinghy, and Bill Hunter. I had a faint surge of hope. Had Ramirez missed them? And if so, could they stay hidden in that misty, turbulent sea? Geordie and I exchanged a glance and then looked quickly away. I crossed over to Taffy, who was helping Claire and maid to assist him. "Looks as though this is an officer's party, Taffy. You'd better stay pretty quiet unless you want to join the rest of the boys. They're in the cable hold." He nodded.
"I'll be all right," he said, and rubbed the back of his neck in a curious gesture, as if he'd been hurt there.
One of the men with rifles said in Spanish, "No speaking. Be silent, all of you." I pretended not to understand and started to speak, but this time the gesture that went with the repeated instruction was clear, and I subsided. I had time to assess the situation now. Neither Ramirez nor Hadley had actually entered the saloon with us. There were only the two armed guards. We were seven. And in the cable hold there were possibly four men. Danny lay dead on the deck. I could barely make myself think about that. And three were, with any luck, still at large. I decided to try a gamble. "It will be all right to let us speak," I said, in the best Spanish I could muster. "Mr. Ramirez will permit it." They glanced at one another, and one of them shrugged. I had guessed correctly. They were so accustomed to being given orders that they would accept this one, even from me, spoken as it had been with an air of authority. I turned to Geordie and told him what I had said in Spanish, with a wary eye to the rifles, but to my relief, the guards gave no further sign of stopping us. Geordie said, "What happens now?"
"That's not up to us.
Ramirez has the next move, and I don't like to think what that will be. We can't do much while they're around. I jerked my head very slightly in the direction of the guards. 7 here, 4 below, Geordie murmured. He had done the same arithmetic that I had, and 3 somewhere. I looked at Campbell, who seemed to be recovering. They're a murderous lot of bastards, aren't they? I wish I'd given Jimmy's head when he wanted to blow a hole in Serena, said Geordie, viciously. Wishful thinking won't help us now. What bothers me most is that I think that's what they may be going to do to us. He shook his head, irritably, and we all lapsed into silence. Claire came over to me, unbuttoned my shirt, and proceeded to patch up what, luckily, proved to be no more than a skin graze, though it hurt me more than the slight wound warranted. I thanked God that we kept small first aid kits all over the ship. As she worked, I felt her hands shaking, just a little, and I grasped them to try and reassure her, but it was a wretched attempt. There was a lot of movement on deck, and a great deal of shouting. Ian looked up at the deckhead speculatively. "I'm thinking they're having trouble, Skipper. There's a hell of a tangle at the masthead." That was all to the good. The longer they took to separate the two ships, the more time we would have to think of a way out of this mess. I looked at the guards and felt very depressed. They looked as though they'd murder their grandmothers for 2 pesetas, and they'd certainly have no qualms about shooting us if we tried anything. It was nearly an hour before anything happened. We used the time to some little advantage. All of us achieved better control over ourselves, and Claire brought her father to a degree of coherence. He had a pretty bad concussion. His speech was affected, although his thinking seemed clear enough. "Go down, sons of bitches," he said, indistinctly. "Why do you quit, Mike?" "Hadley had Claire," I said briefly. "Ah," he sighed, and sagged back on the settee. "I should have let her behind," he muttered. "Never listen to a woman, Mike." He closed his eyes and turned his head away, and Claire and I exchanged worried looks across his head. "It's my fault," Geordie burst out. "I should have kept the lads up to scratch. We should have kept watch. We shouldn't have been surprised like that." "Shut up, Geordie," I said. "That won't get us anywhere. There's no blame, not on us. We weren't looking for trouble." "Aye," said Ian softly. "Yon Ramirez is a lot to answer for." Presently, there was a rattle at the door, and one of the guards opened it. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Taffy slide into a corner, half hidden behind the settee, and then Ramirez came in, as elegant as ever. "I trust you are comfortable," he said, solicitously. "Let's not have any blarney," I said bluntly. "What's the next move, Ramirez?" He smiled, and seemed to be enjoying a huge joke. "Why, I have to introduce you to someone," he said. He leaned out of the door and beckoned to someone in the passage. He turned back to me and said, "I told you once that you shouldn't make libelous statements that you couldn't substantiate." The man who came into the saloon was about my size, dark and heavily bearded. He carried my laboratory notebook in one hand. Ramirez said, "An old friend for you. I think you all know Mr. Mark Trevelyan." 2. As I looked into Mark's eyes, I think my heart started to miss 3 full beats, and I felt their hairs bristle on the nape of my neck. It isn't often that one is confronted by a dead man, especially a dead brother. There was a sound as of a long pent breath being released throughout the saloon, and then the silence was total. Ian was the first to stir. "That's the money I found." His voice tailed off as Mark switched his eyes to him.
Ah, Ian Lewis. So it was you who clobbered me, was it?
He said, pleasantly, and then his voice hardened.
You'd have done better to stay in your Highland hovel, you Scots peasant.
The whole pattern of events of the last few months had suddenly been shuffled like the pieces in a kaleidoscope to present an entirely new picture. It was no wonder that Ian hadn't recognised the bearded man he found in our raid on Serena. He had last seen Mark as a boy. I might have recognised him, but I hadn't taken the trouble to look. We weren't looking for a dead man that night in Nuku'alofa. I looked round at the others. Their expressions were a mixture of amazement and slowly dawning comprehension. Claire gave Mark one long, measured look, then made a small contemptuous sound and turned back to her father. Campbell took her by the wrist protectively, never taking his eyes off Mark. He said nothing. Ian was furious and showed it, while Geordie merely stared speculatively at Mark under lowered brows. Paula had made a sudden move, as if to go to him, but she shrank back and hid in the shadows at Geordie's back. Taffy didn't show himself at all. Of them all, Mark was watching me.
"Hello, Mike," he said, soberly.
I said, "Mark, for God's sake, I..." He was urbane, where I was dumbfounded. He lifted the notebook and some papers in his hand.
"I've been rooting about in your laboratory. So kind of you to have done the preliminary survey for me. I couldn't have done it better myself."
He dropped the papers on the table. Ian looked at him with black anger in his eyes.
"I wish that I'd hit you a bit harder," he said harshly.
Mark smiled at him, but said nothing. He picked up my notebook again and flicked the pages with one hand.
"We seem to have struck it rich, Mike. There may be billions in all this, don't you agree? A pity you wasted your time, but never mind. You saved me a bit of work."
I spoke through a dry throat. "You're a bastard, Mark."
"Oh, come on, Mike. Aren't you maligning Mother?"
He looked around.
"And who else have we?" "Yes, Wilkins, isn't it? What's it like on Tyneside these days, Geordie?"
Geordie showed his disgust.
"A bit cleaner than this saloon." "We will have our little jokes," said Mark lightly. "And my dear old boss, Mr. Campbell, the fallen warrior. And Claire." "I'm sorry you had to be here, Claire."
She refused to look at him and said nothing. It irked Mark, and he shrugged petulantly, turned away and peered behind Geordie.
"And who's the young lady sitting in the shadow?"
he asked.
"I didn't know you were such a one for the ladies, Mike."
He moved round the table and stopped suddenly. His face went very pale.
"Paula,"
he whispered. He turned his head quickly to Ramirez.
"You didn't tell me she was aboard."
Ramirez shrugged.
"Just another woman," he said casually.
For an instant they glared at one another, and I had an insight into their relationship. Paula stood up.
"Mark. Oh, Mark. I thought you were dead. Why didn't you come to me, Mark? Why didn't you trust me?"
Ramirez laughed softly. Mark actually looked troubled.
"I'm truly sorry," he said. "Sorry you had to be on this ship."
He made a curious gesture as though wiping her away, and a prickle ran up my spine. In that one sudden movement, he had rejected us all, wiped us out of his world. Paula took a step forward.
"But Mark, I..."
Ramirez snapped out a curt phrase in Spanish, and one of the guards lifted his rifle. The meaning was unmistakable. Paula stopped dead, and looked at Mark with the comprehension of horror. His eyes flickered, and he looked away from her, and she slowly fell back into a chair and buried her face in her hands. I heard the racking sobs that shook her, and saw Claire move to put her arms round her shoulders. I had to force myself to speak calmly.
"We all thought you were dead.
Why did you do it?
I had to die, he said.
He perked up. The change of subject took his mind off Paula.
The police were after me, and getting a little too close, so I conveniently killed myself.
I suddenly knew another black truth.
You did kill Sven Norgard, didn't you?
He turned on me.
What else could I do?
He said, defensively.
The bloody fool wanted to publish. Him and his bloody scientific integrity. He wanted to give it all away. Billions of dollars that belong to me. To me, do you hear that? I made the discovery, didn't I?
His voice tailed off, and then he added softly, I had to kill him. The silence was murderous, and we all stared at the egomaniacal horror that was my brother. He straightened up and said, And then I killed myself. The police would never look for a dead murderer. Wasn't that pretty clever of me, Mike?
It was stupid, I said flatly.
But then you always were a stupid man. His hand crashed on the table, and we all jerked at the sudden violence. Only Ramirez watched him unmoved and dispassionate.
It wasn't stupid, he yelled. It was a damn good idea, but I'm surrounded by bungling idiots.
Like Kane and Hadley, I said.
That's right, them, he agreed, suddenly calm again. Those damn fools gave me appendicitis of all things. I could have killed that madman Hadley. There was no need to invent extra details.
I'm sure you could, I said. But it was you who bungled it. You should have told them precisely what to say. He betrayed for the first time his lack of authority.
It had nothing to do with me, he said sullenly. Ernesto fixed it.
I shot a sidelong glance at Ramirez.
So, he's a bungler too.
Ramirez smiled sardonically, and Mark said nothing.
I went on. You bungled again when Hadley let your papers and the nodules go. You should have taken them with you. That was bad planning.
They got them back, though.
Not quite, Mark. I had a nodule still. And I had your diary.
He reacted to that with white-faced fury, then subsided and nodded thoughtfully.
You were lucky. You read it?
Oh, yes, I said casually. A simple code, really. And watched him swallow his ire yet again, as item by item I did my best to undermine his self-confidence. Then he suddenly laughed.
That lunatic Hadley. But you all thought I was dead anyway. And poor old Ernesto here was getting all the blame. That was really funny.
Ramirez, who had been leaning negligently against the bulkhead, suddenly straightened, his face cold.
This is a pointless conversation, he said shortly.
Mark said, Oh, let me have my fun, old boy. It isn't often a corpse can hold an inquest on himself. I'm getting a kick out of it.
Ramirez looked at him contemptuously. All right, it won't make any difference, he said dismissively.
I knew that he was only waiting for word that his crew had separated the two ships before he did what he was going to do, and I had a good idea what that was. I rubbed my ear. There seemed to be something getting in the way of my hearing, and Ramirez's voice had seemed to vibrate in a curious way. The ship creaked and rocked uneasily, and I wondered what was really happening outside. But it was also important to me to hear what my brother had to say, and I pushed the thoughts that were bothering me to the background.
My inquest, Mark said again. Let's develop this interesting theme.
Yes, let's do that, said Campbell suddenly. I turned to find him sitting up on the settee, waving away Claire and Ian.
Let's do that, he repeated.
And I noticed that his voice was stronger and his speech clearer.
Let's consider the burning of a hospital and the murder of a doctor and 14 of his patients.
Mark flinched.
I didn't do that. It was Hadley again.
Hadley again, I said caustically.
You sound as pure as Hadley's pal Kane.
You condone.